Hi, everybody. I'm here with Dr. David Luke, who is an associate professor of psychology at the University of Greenwich and an honorary senior lecturer at the Centre for Psychedelic Research at Imperial College London. His research focuses on transpersonal experiences, anomalous phenomena, and altered states of consciousness, especially via psychedelics. He's published more than 100 academic papers in this area and 13 books. So, Dave, welcome.
Hi, Ali. Nice to be here. Thanks.
So I've been looking forward to this interview conversation for a while because there's an area we haven't really covered yet in this conference, which is parapsychology and the weirder, more difficult to explain things that happen when people take psychedelics. So maybe we could start with your definition of parapsychology. What is it?
Yeah, this is great. I'm glad you're including it. So, parapsychology usually covers those kinds of phenomena and experiences which don't ordinarily fit in with mainstream scientific thinking. So, experiences which, if you take them at face value, seem to defy our current scientific understanding of the limits of consciousness and experience. So, that includes things like telepathy, kind of direct mind-to-mind communication, clairvoyance, getting information from a distant location without using inference or your normal sensory apparatus, precognition, getting information from the future, again, without inference or sensory input. Occasionally, also psychokinesis, the direct effect of mind over matter, and also things like out-of-body experiences, near-death experiences, and communication with spirits of the dead or signs of some kind of like afterlife continuity of consciousness.
And so, how common are these kinds of experiences when people take psychedelics?
So on an individual kind of basis, we don't necessarily know like when people take it just once how common they happen, but across the lifetime. So if you look at psychedelic users, generally speaking, they're very common. At some point in your psychedelic career, let's say about 50% of people who have taken psychedelics have had the experience of telepathy, for instance, whilst under the influence, and also like encounters with the spirit or intelligence of the plant they've ingested. About 40% said they've had some kind of communication with like a deceased human, a spirit of the dead. So these experiences are very common amongst people who use psychedelics, and far more common than you'd expect across the normal lifetime or even compared to any other kind of psychoactive drug.
And so, one of the things that always interests me about your work is that, you're a very credentialed, very cited academic, and you're studying two extremely weird areas, right? Psychedelics and parapsychology. What's that been like over the last, your career, but also how have things changed in people's response to your area of research?
Yeah, thanks for asking. So, I mean, I kind of committed double career hara-kiri or seppuku, by career suicide by kind of investigating both parapsychology and psychedelics. And, 25, 30 years ago when I started out, parapsychology was the least taboo of the subjects. So I did a PhD in parapsychology because you couldn't do a doctorate in psychedelic studies back then anywhere. And now this has kind of massively changed, and psychedelics are now no longer taboo, and in fact they're a hot button topic, whereas parapsychology is still very much marginalized and considered to be somewhat fringe, although it's kind of fairly well established in the UK, at least peripherally. So, the landscape has changed, but I think that it's important that we do explore this kind of parapsychological phenomena when we explore psychedelics because, people have these experiences very commonly, and it's also important not to just continue to disregard the full spectrum of human experience. But I'm glad to say at least one of my career moves is starting to pay off.
And yeah, I want to delve in a little bit into the specific unexplained phenomena, let's say, or curious phenomena people are experiencing. So maybe two of them we could look at, and then we'll see where that takes us. But I wanted to look at, because I know you've done research on this, near-death experiences and the potential link between the psychedelic experience and what people report when they have near-death experiences.
So, just to give it a bit of context, I'll probably explain what a near-death experience is first of all. And so, These tend to occur to people who've had, life-threatening incidents or accidents. They're much more prevalent now than they used to be because of CPR and resuscitation procedures. So the phenomena first became kind of noticed in the 1970s, as more and more people were being resuscitated. However, if you have a cardiac arrest, you have a heart attack, chances are you will probably die. And of those small percentages that actually survive, a few of them will also have a near-death experience. But you also get it from other kinds of life-threatening incidents as well, other than just pure cardiac arrest. And the classic syndrome is that, some life-threatening incident occurs, you get hit by a car or whatever, God forbid, and you're kind of lying there on the floor, and then suddenly you feel like you've left your body, and you're looking down on your body, and you go, "Oh dear, look, that doesn't look good. Why am I not in my body? Am I dead?" Paramedics turn up, you kind of watch them, see what's going on. Then you kind of often have a life review. You kind of see your whole life flash before your eyes, perhaps kind of seeing things that you did, which you probably slightly regret, and more so if you happen to kind of keep repeating them, which would be my case. Then you see a tunnel of light, you move down the tunnel of light, and you're about to merge into the light at the end of the tunnel, which is kind of seemingly drawing you towards it. It seems to be like it's very increasingly blissful experience. And then suddenly one of your dead relatives pops up and says, "Oh no, it's not your time. You've got to think of the kids," and back into your body, just as you're being resuscitated by the paramedics. So that's the kind of usual syndrome, right? You don't usually get all of those effects, but that's a kind of classic near-death experience. And so people have drawn parallels to the psychedelic experience as well, over the years, because some psychedelic experiences do overlap with some of that phenomena. You can often find features of the near-death experience in psychedelic trips, though not certainly not in all psychedelic trips, but some, if you aggregate psychedelic experiences, you'll find all of the features of a near-death experience occurring. So our recent research we've been doing at Greenwich, we've been drilling down into the phenomena of the near-death experience and psychedelic experiences, particularly with DMT, which it has been said that DMT is this powerful psychedelic reproducing our body, possibly in our pineal gland, and it may be released at the point of death or when we have a near-death experience, and therefore explains near-death experiences because we have DMT in our body, right? And we don't know why we have this powerful psychedelic in our body or what it does. So it's a great theory. It's been taken as gospel on the internet quite a lot. But when we look at near-death experiences and DMT experiences, sure, on paper, when you give people a measure, what's called the near-death experience scale, people score highly on that when they have a near-death experience. And they also score highly when they have a DMT experience as well, generally, like as a group. But when you look at individual phenomenology of people's experiences, you start to see differences. So it's quite rare that people encounter dead relatives on DMT, although it can happen. People don't tend to have a point of no return, which you get on in near-death experiences. The life reviews are also relatively uncommon as well. And there are some features of the psychedelic experience, such as with DMT, you definitely don't really get very often in near-death experiences. I won't go into some of the ruder versions that Rick Strassman reported, but things like geometric patterns, which pretty much everybody gets on DMT, you very, very rarely see with near-death experiences. I've come across one account. So there's a bit of a mismatch with it. Although they're good models, and the fact we have DMT in the brain, and seemingly, at least in rodents, they've found a jump of the increase of DMT in the brain at the point of death, it certainly doesn't explain everything, but it may be part of the explanation of near-death experiences.
Yeah, fascinating. And it leads us into the next thing I wanted to ask you about, which is, firstly, I've never been convinced by that link because of the points you make, but also because I've never heard, someone report a near-death experience and talk about, insectoid aliens and jester-like entities flooding. I've often, when people equate the Some people talk about the DMT experience as like the bardo, the place between life and death in the Tibetan Book of the Dead, which is an interesting theory. But, you know, anytime someone's asked me, do I think it is the afterlife? I always say, I hope not, because it's quite terrifying. Yeah. So there do seem to be these pretty significant differences. But in one of your papers, you talk about the fact that actually the UFO abduction experience might be closer to certainly the DMT experience. So could you talk about that a bit? Like, what's the link there?
So the UFO abduction phenomena again started kind of coming to prominence in the 70s, 80s. You know, there have been accounts since the kind of 1940s, but it was really Whitley Strieber's book, is it Abduction, I think it's called, that kind of popularized the idea, and it really took off in the American imagination. And you know, by some estimates, hundreds of thousands of people had alien abduction experiences, especially in the States, it turns out, but not so much elsewhere. But some psychologists started beginning to take this quite seriously, such as the Harvard psychiatry professor, John Mack. He kind of interviewed a whole bunch of people who had these kind of syndrome of experiences, which they called alien abduction like phenomena. In that they would have large sections of missing time, encounters with some kind of beings which took them off somewhere for some kind of probes or inspections, super high-tech kind of alien facilities or some kind of mothership, maybe involved in some kind of breeding program or experimentation, and then were kind of placed back in their body, but then had this kind of period of missing time and so on. So they're kind of extraordinary phenomena. And, you know, whether or not there really is alien abductions, right? The people really strongly believed that they'd had this experience. So, you know, I think the experiences were real, but, you know, the explanation of it being an alien abduction is questionable, right? But there are a large group of people who have those kinds of experiences. And Rick Strassman hinted at it in his book about DMT, in his study he did in the 90s, in that it could account for some of this phenomena, given that, again, DMT is endogenous. It's kind of naturally occurring in the human body. It's intensely psychedelic, and it shares some of the features with this kind of alien abduction phenomena when you take it. So encounters with alien-like beings, conducting operations on you, taking you off to some hyper-technologized place, and occasionally breeding programs, although we don't see that very much with DMT, but we do see that kind of phenomena with the kind of classic pre-psychedelic era encounters with little people. So like folkloric accounts of people getting abducted by pixies, elves, gnomes, goblins, etc., which seem to be the kind of the pre-UFO kind of folkloric experience of the alien abduction. You know, so those kind of experiences look very synonymous, both spontaneous, that people have these experiences of being taken off by strange looking humanoids, and when you compare them, yes, like the folkloric accounts of pixies and elves kind of match these kind of almond-eyed, kind of strange-headed, diminished kind of alien kind of characters as well. So in a way, it looks like the alien abduction phenomena is kind of like a modernized, technologized version of the old folkloric accounts of pixie, elf, mini little people encounters. And that endogenous DMT could account for those experiences. The theory being that at some point our DMT levels in some people may just kind of tip over a threshold, a tipping point, and give you a spontaneous experience which feels like you've been abducted by aliens. So, you know, you probably can attest to this. Some DMT experiences do feel a bit alien, to say the least.
Yes, to say the least. Yeah, definitely. I've always found that link really, really fascinating. And people are often alone in an isolated place, from what I understand. That's often a common feature of it, and it's at night. And, you know, so it's interesting. If people are interested in Rick Strassman's work, he's a guest in the conference as well, and they can check out that interview. And, you know, this idea of endogenous DMT seems to hasn't had as much research as it could. You know, he was suggesting that we should genetically engineer mice and rats to either have no DMT produced or have loads of DMT produced. So really a bit disturbing, but interesting to see what might happen.
See if they get abducted by aliens.
They get abducted. Yeah, do they report on the abduction scale? The little pause. So you know, the question that often comes up in these conversations is, okay, something is going on, whether it's psychological or, you know, some aspect of being human, where we are encountering these other intelligences, you know, for thousands of years in our folklore, and then now it manifests as potentially the UFO abduction experience. The question most of us are always curious about is it real, right? And how would we tell if it's real? And so there is this, there is this question, I know you've done some research on this, like, could we go into these DMT spaces, for example, and come back with some kind of information where we could then definitively say, or say, you know, with a reasonable level of certainty, look, this is information I couldn't have gotten from elsewhere, ta-da. What are some of the, potentials and pitfalls with that kind of research?
Yeah, sure. So, it's clear that like these alien abduction encounters and other kind of phenomena, entity encounters, are not really out there. You know, they're out there. They're more likely in there, right? And that doesn't necessarily mean they're not real, but that we don't have any kind of externally objective kind of information about their existence. It's all based on people's subjective experiences. Now, that doesn't mean they're not real. But it certainly doesn't mean that they're not felt to be real, because, for instance, people who have a DMT entity encounter, the vast majority of them feel like the experience was real, that the entities themselves they encounter, which are very common, are real. Something like 70 to 80% of DMT entity encounter experiences say that was more real than this real, in fact, you know. So that leads us to want to explore them and not necessarily just try and explain them away. But it's very difficult to try and establish the reality of a subjective experience when only that one person is having that experience. It gets more interesting, say, if people have shared hallucinations, so-called, or shared experiences or shared visionary states, whereby two people independently encounter the same experience. And there's a kind of a growing body of data which kind of maybe hints at that in some way, in that the kinds of beings that people encounter can fall into kind of distinct types that occur more often than you'd expect if it was just purely random kind of neurochemical firing, for such as encounters with the little people seem to be very common. 15 to 25% DMT users have had that experience. Encounters with jesters, you know, clowns, these kind of trickster kind of characters, also very common, you know, circus kind of ringmasters and harlequins, these kind of weird trickster characters, they pop up a lot. And then some even more obscure / terrifying encounters, which are very specific, which, you know, don't fit into this kind of, well, it's just a kind of archetype, you know, little people, tricksters, you know, harlequins, are very specific, like encounters with giant 25 foot tall, often, or sometimes a little bit smaller, praying mantises or giant insectoid creatures, which are nearly always kind of leaning over the experience and doing kind of weird brain operations on them, often extracting their emotions, maybe farming them for their emotions. They don't seem to have any kind of emotions themselves. Mostly seen as neutral and occasionally benign, but people feel like they're having their kind of brains upgraded often. So that's a really specific kind of experience syndrome that people are having. And you know, thankfully it isn't that common, but common enough, it's kind of slightly freaky, right? That, you know, I've come across dozens and dozens of accounts of people having that experience, seemingly independently and naively of other people's encounters with giant praying mantises, right? So that's one level of data. Like just the kind of commonality of the experiences, which should be by all of the means, kind of somewhat random. Right, we can begin to explain that a little bit, perhaps, by the idea of, memes, that people have been influenced by the cultural memes floating around associated with these experiences, right? If you've listened to a Terence McKenna talk, right, he frequently says, like, you get elves, everyone does, right? So therefore everyone's kind of primed to see elves. Or, that's what we might think. So we can never get beyond like the possible cultural influences priming people's experiences. However, like from the very first DMT trip reports from the 1950s, people are having encounters with little people. And that was kind of written up in some obscure journal in Hungarian, in a psychiatry journal, which nobody had probably read for decades, right? So, we find these encounters from the get-go. So it's hard to kind of extract the kind of cultural influences, but yeah, I don't think we should disregard the possibility that there's something inherent about the DMT trip which induces encounters with little people. So the next level of trying to explain it then is to try and verify it objectively that people are going to some other realm and bringing back verifiable information that they couldn't get otherwise, right? So we could do that through kind of classic parapsychological experiments like experiencing clairvoyance or telepathy or precognition, which I've been doing. I've done numerous experiments like this. The results are often very significant in my studies, or significant enough, in that people seemingly are able to demonstrate accessing information outside of space-time, in a way in which they shouldn't ordinarily be able to do. However, people don't need DMT to get that kind of results in the lab anyway, right? We see that from all kinds of altered states and even other experiments in parapsychology. The evidence for precognition and clairvoyance and telepathy is kind of, although the effects are very small, they are quite robust over the last 100 years of experiments, whether or not people are on DMT or not. So DMT alone isn't enough to induce that kind of phenomena anyway. So DMT may not be like a good causative factor. So maybe that isn't the best kind of research. So the next best thing we've been looking at is whether or not people can have actual, well, whether or not they can bring back verifiable information that is somehow something that we couldn't possibly know. So there were some people propose that you give the DMT entities maths tests, like, kind of solutions to unknown mathematical problems, right? And that would verify their existence. But these are all kind of flawed explanations because seemingly there's no potential limit to what is possible with unconscious psychic processes, according to the literature, right? To give you a famous example, well, it should be famous, but it's not. Nobody really knows about this research. It's very obscure. But there was a psychic medium who she wasn't professional. She was a kind of housewife, but she also professed to have these abilities to speak with spirits of the dead, right? Which is fairly common occurrence. And supposedly she had made contact with this kind of dead chess grandmaster. And so they arranged a match for her with a current chess grandmaster, right? And the idea would be that if she can play a decent game, she might be genuine, right? And of course, she played the game, and the living chess grandmaster said, well, that was amazing. Only another chess grandmaster of my standard could play a game to that standard. Okay. And this was before AI was able to beat, chess grandmasters, right? It was done a few decades ago. And everyone was like, wow, so she must be channeling this dead grandmaster. Or, though not everyone really thought of this, is either that or she's just kind of getting the moves telepathically from the guy she's playing anyway, right? So we can never really account for communications with discarnate entities by psychic information alone, like clairvoyance or telepathy or precognition, could always explain information you supposedly getting from some discarnate source. So, you know, we have to accept, well, it might only be telepathy, okay, or only clairvoyance, but it doesn't give us any evidence that this information is really coming from discarnate sources, i.e. entities or spirits of the dead. So the approach that we've been taking, which is a little bit more radical, is to look at kind of shared visionary experiences, whether or not if two people blindly or under other conditions are going into an experience together, or with the intention of sharing their experience. Because this is something that people commonly report in ayahuasca ceremonies. You know, they'll say, oh, you know, I was kind of there with the other person, the other side of the room, and we both had the same experience, and they had this kind of knowing, and they come out of the experience, they're like, were you also there? And they were like, yes, I had the same thing as you. And you know, people feel like they've had these shared experiences on ayahuasca. So we're trying to get this experimentally, and having people in pairs, you know, take DMT with the intention of having a shared experience. We keep them separate beforehand. They only interact by, you know, they kind of meet each other, say hello. They do a short breathing exercise together to get into the mood. They set the intention of having a shared trip. And then as soon as they come out of the trip, we separate them again and we interview them and we get them to do sketches of their experiences. Now, we got to the point where we've got all that data. And I didn't think, I thought it was going to be a massive long shot, really, to get any signal there. But I, on the surface, on the face value, I was quite surprised by some of the, you know, the correspondence of some of those reports, right? It was kind of seemingly at face value, some of them were pretty impressive. However, that isn't very objective, me just going, oh, well, that looks really similar. So we're now in the process of getting dozens of other people to blind judge all of these shared DMT experiences, okay, relative to people who weren't in a shared condition, and rating them to see like which trip reports are most similar to each other. It's a really kind of intense process with a lot of statistics involved as well, and we haven't kind of finished that yet, but on the surface of it, some of them look quite astonishing. So you know, I reserve judgment for now.
I love that. That's fascinating. And I'm really looking forward to seeing where that goes as well. And you know, having had experiences on DMT, other psychedelics, and not on psychedelics, which are quite difficult to explain, I think me and many others, I think it's very common that people have had, you know, a loved one passes away and they have a, you know, a sense of, you know, they find something, some object that's been lost for 20 years. And, you know, it's just, all these different stories. It's quite, seems like there's something going on. And so, The last thing I wanted to ask you about is, this is great, because this is a version of a question I ask everyone else, but slightly different for you, because, yeah, you know, as psychedelics go mainstream, they're going mainstream in a few different areas, obviously medicine being one, retreat centers, you know, creativity research, etc. I just had a vision just now of like, sort of like Xavier's School for the Gifted, X-Men type school, right? If you could start a school which was investigating the potential of psychedelics to help us tap into or understand at least these more, you know, these stranger qualities or capacities we have as human, what would be some of the things you'd want to, imagine you had a sort of, not unlimited, but you have a massive research budget, what would be some of the things you'd want to start, you know, researching?
So some of this phenomena, particularly, you know, the nature of those experiences which seemingly transcend time and space, and possibly encounters with other seemingly sentient discarnate beings, right? I think that's super important and vital. It's effectively what indigenous shamanic people have been doing for decades, hundreds of years, thousands of years, you know, but without the kind of science labs and budgets, just kind of culturally. So, you know, it'd be very important for me, I think, to see this kind of collusion or collaboration between indigenous shamanic peoples, indigenous people who make use of psychedelics, and scientists. I think and to do that humbly, in a way where we are really listening and open-minded about this, because we have this kind of group of people who've been using these things for thousands of years and go, oh yeah, you can transcend time and space and bring back information which is useful for your community and communicate with all these different beings and yeah, et cetera, et cetera. It's like, that's just a given. That's kind of like a fundamental. And yet, where we are currently in science, it's like, all that's kind of really woo-woo and taboo and flim-flam and juju and any other kind of weird juvenile words you want to apply to it, right? But we are the juveniles here because we haven't really been exploring these things for very long, and yet we assume to know what's actually really going on and what reality is, et cetera, et cetera. And what we don't have the answer. So yeah, I'd really love to see psychic abilities explored, encounters with other beings. I think the potential benefits for nature contact is hugely important as well. And also, like, not just like increasing people's nature connection, which we know reliably occurs when people take psychedelics, but genuinely interacting with nature in a different way, as do shamans. So there's a few different kind of approaches to this. One is just like the communication with other species, which indigenous people feel that they often have when they use these alt states, and also like even transforming into other species, not kind of physically, literally, but kind of mentally through one's consciousness. And this is something that indigenous people reliably do. And this also fits in with kind of creative problem solving, in that the anthropology of the what we call epistemology, which is how you obtain knowledge of the indigenous people of the Americas, is underpinned by what's called perspectivism. That is, if you want to know something, you turn into that thing. And you do that by drinking ayahuasca or eating peyote or whatever it is. Okay, I want to understand this plant and what its potential benefits and properties are, and its character and its personality and all the rest of it that goes with it. And so you take a psychedelic and you sit with that thing and you turn into that thing, like in your mind. You meld with it. You like become one with it. And then you understand its medicinal properties and how to utilize it and how to set up a good relationship with it, et cetera, et cetera. Which is something indigenous people in the Americas, those who still have intact traditions, reliably report. And they often do that with psychedelics. Now, this is the kind of complete opposite end of the spectrum from objective scientific approaches, right? Is we want to try and understand something. We try and step back from it as far as possible. We sample it, we take it out of its natural environment, we desiccate it, we kind of atomize it, we chop it up, we stick it under a microscope, and we try and remove ourselves from it as much as possible and remove it from its natural context. And we call that objective science, right? And yes, you can learn a lot through that process, but you're missing out on a lot of other stuff about the nature of this relationship. And thankfully, this is something we're starting now to see occurring spontaneously with Westerners who make use of psychedelics, right? And I think there's something huge to be gained here. So we can see examples of this kind of perspectivism in scientific creative problem solving with people like Carey Mullis, when the Nobel Prize for his discovery of polymerase chain reaction. Whereby you can take a single strand of DNA and replicate it, right? Which is brilliant. It's the basis of all genome research, genetic testing, genetic sequencing, everything uses PCR. Carey Mullis rightly won the Nobel Prize for his discovery. But he basically said afterwards that he'd taken loads of LSD and he was able to kind of fly alongside the strands of the DNA molecule and see what was going on, right? So that is a kind of perspectivism. That is kind of effectively what indigenous people do when they want to know something, and they have access to psychedelics and other altered states. And we're starting to see this now amongst non-indigenous people who take psychedelics. So some of the surveys I've done, looking at increases in nature relatedness and what the kind of things are that are driving those experiences, we find that 25% of people who take an ayahuasca had had the experience of turning into another species, right? And now that could be culturally driven by people going off to retreats in Peru, and it's part of the indigenous worldview that you take ayahuasca and you turn into another species, right? Great. But we also find it with, kind of very secular Western synthetic psychedelics like LSD. 10% of people taking LSD have also had the experience of turning into another species. And that is the underlying principle of this perspectivism, which we see in indigenous cultures. And we can see how this can be used in creative problem solving. So people like Merlin Sheldrake, we did an experiment looking at creative problem solving with top-level scientists with PhDs in maths and physics, biology, engineering. One of them was Merlin Sheldrake, the biologist, and he came into the lab to work on a problem he had to do with a relation. He'd been working on it for his PhD for 3 years, nature of this relationship between a plant and a fungus. Seemingly in the fungus, well, the plant gets all its energy from the fungus and it doesn't photosynthesize. It doesn't have chlorophyll, unlike 99% of all of the plants. And it seemed like it was a parasitic relationship, but he didn't really know. He'd been studying it for 3 years. He came to our lab, we gave him LSD, and he had the experience of turning into the fungus, right? And so for him, for the first time, he said he had a completely different perspective on his problem, which he had been looking at for 3 years as a human being, as Merlin Sheldrake, the biologist. And yet, the moment he has an LSD experience and turns into the fungus, it gives him a whole different set of ideas about the nature of this relationship. Because he said he was able to grow inside the rootstock of the plant and see what was going on from the perspective of the fungus. So this kind of indigenous worldviews and psychedelic-induced kind of cognitive functions like perspectivism can be utilized. And I think that's the kind of stuff we need to explore, if nothing else, to bridge this divide between shamanism and science, which is a kind of archaic science anyway, and better utilize some of this wisdom in a way in which we don't continue to destroy the planet. Because, our current objective kind of materialist on both senses kind of thinking has led us to the brink of total ecological collapse and disaster. And, as Einstein said, the same kind of thinking that got you into the problem is not the kind of thinking that's going to get you out of that problem. So, like, I think there's a lot we can utilize about cognitive functions and psychedelics, taking a shamanic perspective. And that includes psychic abilities, encounters with other beings, perspectivism, creative problem solving, and connection to nature.
Fantastic. Yeah, that's really, really interesting. And I think that's such an important piece to bring in around perspectivism. If people want to check out another example of that, Bruce Damer's talk in this conference talking about, a new lens on the origins of life that he got through an ayahuasca journey is also fascinating. And these examples just keep popping up. I think it's one of the most exciting areas of study right now. So, Dave Luke, thank you. Thank you very much. This was great as always.
That's all. Thanks, Ali.